listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
More bombs were apparently discovered between Thursday and early Friday, including one intended for the former Vice President Joe Biden, and another for actor Robert De Niro. There's a report that the Postal Service indicates some packages were mailed from Florida. We discussed with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer at Moscow State University, what these reports look like from Russia.
Well, Mark, the big story here is all about these, I think they're up to 11 pipe bombs now. They aren't really bombs because I heard this morning they don't really have detonation, you know, triggers, but that were sent to Democratic politicians and anti-Trump Hollywood types. Curious about what that the optics are in Moscow over all of this.
What? Did you say anthrax scare?
No, right.
I just had this flash of deja vu.
Me too, actually.
Yeah. A bunch of fake pipe bombs get sent to... I think first it was politicians and figures on one side of the aisle, including George Soros. And then the next day it was some on the other side of the aisle. And we're not paying any attention. The usual U.S. domestic hysteria.
They're blaming it on Russia. They started that this morning. MSNBC said, wait a minute, maybe Russia did
it. Some complete retard at Chuck Todd just speculates out of everything that, Russia's doing everything else. Why not fake mail bombs too? It could be a Russian operation. What? Why not? Right.
So could Berman.
More Russia.
Right. Yeah, but meanwhile, we've got some actual serious business going on, and this kind of thing you know, you remember the anthrax stuff came at the same time that they were implementing the USA Patriot Act. It was kind of the icing on the yeah. cake of the 9/11 airplane crashes. And so who knows what goes with this, but the INF treaty being abrogated by the U.S., while they blame Russia for abrogating it, is a little more troubling, I think.
Yeah, I mean, well, this is a big deal.
Well, the INF treaty. I said ABM, I meant INF.
INF. Yeah, the ABM treaty was the last treaty that the U.S. unilaterally pulled on.
George Bush did that one, right.
Yes, in 2001, which very much has had an impact on U.S.-Russia strategic relations and political relations leading up to today, with the Trump administration announced it is moving out of the intermediate range nuclear forces, the INF treaty. I think we should start with a little summary of what that treaty is, because I guess it's already a little old for those of us that have come into fruition after the Cold War ended.
Right.
It was a treaty signed in 1987. Between then President Reagan and Gorbachev, and it was, the goal was to eliminate short and immediate and intermediate range nuclear weapons. We're talking it's 500 to 5,500 kilometers, which I guess is like roughly 340 to 3,400 and some miles. That's the range of what we're looking at, and it had some curious limitations, mostly by the technology of the day, but it only banned land-based intermediate range nuclear missiles of those ranges. It did not affect sea, air, or now drone-launched missiles, which is actually kind of crucial to where we get to today with the treaty. Right. The goal of the treaty was basically to take nuclear missiles take nuclear missiles out of Europe,
right.
Both sides of Europe, right? Because then Europe, it was a completely different geopolitical context. Europe was divided almost down the middle, and Eastern Europe was members of the Warsaw Pact. Right. So there were missiles, intermediate and short range missiles in Europe pointed at each, you know, other sides of Europe, you know, at each other.
Right.
And you know, it's a completely different geopolitical context today. So it was to take, you know, the missiles out of Europe, but also to try to take Europe out of the heavy blows of nuclear conflict.
Right. I mean, just for people to understand, really, I think another way of looking at it is the U.S. had the Atlantic Ocean and Western Europe between it and the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union had the Warsaw Pact countries.
On one side of the country.
Right.
Yeah, at least on one. I mean, we have to remember that Alaska is only a few miles away from Russia.
Right.
You know, less than,
right.
But I'm talking about the other side.
The mainland.
But of course, that's the non-strategic side. And it's much shorter distance over the Arctic, which is where most missiles would actually be fired, not over Europe. But
correct.
So anyway, it did not do anything about long-range nuclear missiles. So those would be limited in number down to an acceptable total to wipe out the world only a couple times each. Start one start two never took off, but New Start, eventually with Obama. And New Start is also due to expire in 2001, and the Trump administration has already indicated that if it is still in office, that it sees no reason to renew or renegotiate that treaty in any way.
Right.
Which would be the last Cold War era arms control treaty.
Right.
Now, it did not eliminate long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles. It did not outlaw, it did not ban intermediate-range nuclear missiles launched by sea or by air or now by drone. And it did not prevent any other countries other than the U.S. and the Soviet Union, Russia as the legal inheritor, then Russia, from owning these intermediate range nuclear weapons. And one of the misconceptions is that you can always fire a long range, that is an intercontinental ballistic missile, at a shorter target. Right. I mean, you could always do that if you really wanted to. So you could target an intermediate range, a long range, an intercontinental ballistic missile at a short or intermediate range, if that was your goal. But of course, with also the limitation of the total number of missiles and warheads in the START treaties, the idea was that, you know, you would then try to target them at your main enemy. And this, again, was to try to save Europe. And in the theoretical, the big loser from the U.S. pulling out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty is Europe.
Europe, yeah. Now it's battlefield.
Potentially. We'll talk about that.
Yeah.
Because the U.S., I mean, other than Alaska, is not threatened by potential Russian intermediate range weapons.
Right.
And Russia is not threatened by U.S. intermediate range land-based, again, weapons, unless they can convince countries in Europe and or Asia, which brings us to another side of the whole thing,
right,
to station nuclear weapons on their territory, which would, of course, make them a target of Russian intermediate. And Putin has already said that. If you put, you know, just like in the years leading up to the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, when the U.S. was putting Pershing 2 missiles in Europe, and the U.S.'s first cruise missiles at the time, with potential for nuclear warheads. If you put those missiles there, we will have to target you. It's just strategic.
Right.
It's nothing personal.
Right.
Right. If you're stupid enough to do that, then you become a target.
Right.
So notice that it's both Russia and the U.S. have accused each other of violating this treaty for years. And as it's a guess, right, an educated guess. But as far as I can tell, both countries are violating it in small ways. The U.S. accuses Russia of developing a land-based variant of a legal cruise missile, a sea-launched cruise missile, the Caliber, the one that we saw Russia use to great effect in Syria, firing from as far away as the Caspian. They said they have developed a land-based variant of that, which is designated the 9M729, and that the ranges of this missile fall into the prescribed range of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Russia denies this, not that they have the missile, but that the ranges fall into that prescribed range. Russia, meanwhile, first of all, Russia has a very tenuous relationship with the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, because after the United States pulled out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty in 2001 unilaterally, Putin was very clear that, you know, that we don't know if the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty is any longer in our strategic interests, it's in our national security interests. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of people in Moscow, military, political, at the time, who wanted Russia to themselves to immediately pull out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty when George W. Bush pulled out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. The reason for this is one of the main reasons for pulling out for the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, other than, you know, to pull, take Europe out of the picture, is because of the response time. Intermediate range missiles fired at each other from Europe and from Western Russia towards Europe would have about an 8-minute window until impact. 8 minutes.
Right.
And when you're talking buildings like Stalin's Seven Sisters, two of which are government buildings, others are university, but one of them is the foreign ministry. And if you were at the top of that building,
18
and you were
minutes,
trying,
right?
Yeah, if you were trying to get to the basement, the bunkers underneath, for some modicum of protection, the government built bunkers beneath that building, you might not get there in time. That's how fast those missiles are. So that was one of the main concerns. That these were too dangerous because of the potential for mistakes, mainly. I mean, other than the response time, which would be a great first strike, but capability in some respect. But it reduces the window for decision making, right?
Yes, hair trigger.
Where sometimes both countries received false data, readings that the other side had launched. This happened several times during the Cold War, right? And they had enough time. Thank God, the world is still here. That on both sides, this occurred where people questioned the positive indication of firing from the other side, and it turned out to be false. With an intermediate range weapons, that window for the decision making, for checking, for making that hard decision, is this real, is it not, was a mistake made, was one launched by a rogue actor, was it a mistake, do we have to go full nuclear, could we do a limited response that would maintain the status quo and save the world, those go out, would have gone out the window with intermediate range weapons from Europe and the Warsaw Pact fired at each other, Western and the Warsaw Pact. In a way, that however is an outdated concern, because of the U.S. putting of anti-ballistic missile defense in Europe. Russia has had to develop missiles, weapons, that would be able to evade U.S. anti-ballistic missile weapons in Poland, Romania, now in South Korea, in the U.K., sea-based, all around, right? They're trying to stretch a net around Russia and China of anti-ballistic missile defense. No one system, of course, could alleviate, but the idea is to layer and build, have a land-based variant here, a sea-based there, potentially a satellite in the future there, to build and build and build capability and integrate it together until it actually then becomes where it would actually present a real threat to Russia's full-scale strategic deterrent and enable a first strike capability. And Russia can't allow that. So they have to develop missiles that evade that. And one of the main ways to do that is with a type of weapon that all of the major great powers, the US, Russia, China, India, the EU, even some other countries are building, is hypersonic weapons. And one of the main things of hypersonic weapons, they do several things, but the first one is they move really, really fast. that window that was saved, that time window that was saved by pulling out the intermediate range nuclear forces, is gone now. Simply because the U.S. had to respond to maintain the strategic balance of mutually assured destruction. And Russia was quite clear what the consequences of pulling out of the ABM treaty at the time would be, what they would have to do. And several times along the way, they iterated what we're doing. Here we are, and Russia is now deploying, the first country to, as far as we know, deploy hypersonic weapons. And that window is now gone. So that whole point of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty is not important. But Russia's primary concern with the U.S., how they say the U.S. is violating it, they talk about three ways, but the most substantial and credible way is that when the U.S. puts these anti-ballistic missile interceptors in Romania, the type of launcher used is the MK-41, which is the same Aegis system that is put aboard U.S. naval ships. I'm familiar with it, having served in the U.S. Navy. And they call it actually the Aegis Ashore system. Now, remember again that sea-based missiles were never forbidden by the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. As well as providing an anti-ship and missile capability, the Aegis can also fire cruise missiles, which means that the Aegis Ashore system placed in
It's an intermediate range launch. It's an intermediate range launch device, right?
It can quickly, according to Russian engineers, be retrofitted for that other purpose and fire cruise missiles, land-based cruise missiles, which would be intermediate range and hence lands-based, fall under the INF treaty right at Russia.
Right.
And the so you not only – you know, did you pull out of the ABM treaty and put up anti-ballistic missile defense threatening our deterrent, but then you get a disguised potential launcher to fire intermediate range missiles, potentially nuclear tipped as well. And Russia said, and Russia's quite right, launchers are also forbidden by that treaty, right? Not just right. The intermediate range missiles and their deployment, but the launchers themselves are forbidden. So Russia says that's how the U.S. And the Russia's U.S. response to that is never that we couldn't do that, but that we have no missiles there. Well,
right.
That doesn't mean it's not a violation right. of the treaty. Yeah, right. They said, we have no secret missiles in Europe.
Right.
You didn't answer the question, right? Right. You know, how quickly could Gay get there, be shipped there, you know, in a moment of international crisis? Pretty fast, I'm guessing. That's the deal there. So it seems that both countries were violating it
right.
in some small not yet existential ways.
Yeah, that's where and I wanted to go. Yeah, because I'm just saying maybe the whole architecture that was assembled from like the test ban treaty and the NPT in the 1960s up until the most recent the SALT treaties and all of that kind of outdated for the weaponry of today and the strategic position
exactly.
of today.
All of the old Cold War era treaties, the ABM treaty is gone, the Intermediate Range Forces Treaty, New START, expires and is probably not going to be a route. The conventional armed forces in Europe and the NATO-Russia Founding Act are just being completely ignored at this point. The only reason mm-hmm. Russia hasn't pulled out of them is because they haven't had a good idea, a plan B of where to go from there, but they are not being observed in any meaningful way, at least by the United States. So, has essentially permanently deployed forces right on Russia's border. So all of this Cold War era architecture that set the rules of the game, that made the world a bit safer by providing a modicum of respect, rules of the road, rules of the game, some respect between the two powers, and some predictability, thus providing stability. That's all gone now. And in a way, it's part of new geopolitical realities.
Right.
And in another way, it's part of the advance of technology. But right. to be perfectly honest, I consider the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty archaic. I don't think right. it's such a big deal that the United States has pulled out of it. And I think that the Kremlin says the world is being made more dangerous. The U.S. is pulling out of another treaty. But I think that they are secretly not entirely displeased to see the U.S. do this and take the political heat for unilaterally pulling out of yet another major international treaty. And the real reason – you notice that it's not Europe that is complaining about Russia's supposed violation of this treaty.
Right.
It's not Europe, the ones who have the most to lose, that is demanding that Russia – they're not even demanding that Russia really respect the treaty. We haven't heard any loud voices of that. They haven't called for negotiations.
No, they've been like Trump bashing and saying, this is dangerous.
It's dangerous because if it's being violated – again, it's probably by both sides and in not really a major way. Here's the real reason the U.S. wants out of this treaty: China.
Yeah.
It's about China, because China is not like Europe and other major countries, and we're in a multipolar world now with great powers, is not a party of this treaty. And some 90% of China's missiles would fall within the range of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Not only, the nuclear ones, of course, but, the U.S. is looking
right.
All these people keep saying this Thucydides trap that, a war with with China and the U.S. and the Pacific is inevitable. Well, yeah, if you keep running naval parades right along the Chinese coast and the Taiwan Strait, yeah, I guess you are making it somewhat inevitable, on the other side of the world from the United States, claiming freedom of navigation. The only country that has threatened navigation blockades or interdictions in the past few years has been the United States.
Always, certainly
hasn't
right.
been China. China depends on global trade. They need free trade coming in and out of their country in order to make their economy work, grow their economy in order to provide political stability. They have in no way, shape, or form ever threatened freedom of movement. It just becomes an excuse for saber rattling, a show of force, and to assert U.S. gunboat diplomacy again,
right.
which China has a bad memory of. But anyway, so China has developed a lot of missiles, right, that in a potential conflict with the U.S. in the South China Sea, over Taiwan, something like that, the U.S. tries to stick its big, powerful navy and aircraft carriers off of China's coast, and China unleashes a hailstorm of missiles now. And the U.S. is really upset about
and
this.
And on Okinawa, South Korea, Guam, the whole...
Well, yes. Yeah. And so, and also there's a bit of the politics of the different military services and all of this. Sea and air-based, drone-launched as well, nuclear missiles and nuclear missiles, of course, are not prohibited by this treaty. So the Navy and the Air Force already right. still have that credible deterrent and capability, but the Army doesn't. And the Army wants to get involved in this buildup, this containment, this potential future war with China, because they're largely kind of left out of it, because it would mostly at this point be a naval and air thing. So they want land-based missiles put in Guam and Japan and elsewhere in the Pacific so they can get in on this game and, of course, get in on the gravy train, the money that comes with it. It's this weird U.S. interagency military branch rivalry there. So you notice that Trump, Bolton, multiple times when they are talking about why they're getting rid of this treaty, they mention Russia. But and its violations. But then in the next breath, they mention China, and you see where the right. real intent is there.
Sure. Right.
Now, I think that this is actually an opportunity, if it was taken, and I don't think necessarily, I'm not saying that the Trump administration means to. It would be nice, but with the neocons, I don't see it. But maybe with the next administration, an opportunity here to recraft a modern arms control treaty
yeah.
that would be truly international and global, that
right.
would bring China into it, that
I
would
was
bring
ask
the UK
that.
And France.
You say that, the first thing I was thinking of was Trump's negotiating strategy towards North Korea. And I was wondering if this was.
That's why I say
replay.
I don't think, it's bluff, right? Bluff,
right.
bluster. It could be. I Bolton, I don't think. He seems to be driving a lot right now,
and
he's driving this one. I don't think that's his intentions. But even if the Trump administration doesn't, if we make that assumption, whether it's true or not, certainly the next president, and that's only a couple years away, and
right.
it would be an arms control treaty for a truly multipolar world,
right.
reflecting geopolitical realities.
Right.
Reflecting multiple power centers, again, U.S., Russia, China, the EU,
yep.
the U.K.,
yep.
India,
and
potentially South Korea, Japan.
On that, I'm thinking, for example, the last administration created, in essence, a strategic partnership between Russia and China. And if you were to renegotiate the existing architecture into something modern in terms of arms yeah. control and bring China into it, there are, moves that the U.S. can make towards China that where China's interests might diverge a little from Russia's, the same with Russia to China. In other words, you can maybe spin a little multipolarity out of this thing just by its nature.
And not only, restore a modicum of peace with Russia, but also...
Right.
do a lot towards lowering tensions, these growing tensions that everyone keeps talking about with the U.S. and China, which I think might potentially be even more important. And let's not only include land-based intermediate. Let's talk about sea, air, and drone
all
launched
of it.
Ones.
And defensive.
Let's talk about hypersonic weapons. Let's talk about
satellites, defense,
and sentient killing machines, AIs, which are right around the corner. Let's talk about hypersonic glide vehicles. Why don't we talk about cyber warfare while we're at it?
Could we talk about disarmament at some point?
Let's not go too far. That's like a crazy.
Because we got that NPT, but we also have that's supposed to be. We're supposed to be moving towards nuclear disarmament.
That has never been observed.
Never.
It was
negotiated, signed, approved, and all of that. But I'm wondering if maybe. It's almost time. I mean, a lot of what Trump has been doing has been what Montero calls it, like imperial retreat or whatever, like trying to drop the overhead on the military, basically.
Retrenchment.
Right.
Retrenchment, yeah.
And so, if there's a natural tendency towards that or an appropriate move towards that for economic reasons, well, wouldn't this process be a place to, sort of build that in?
Yeah, well, let me be perfectly honest. Russia is never going to give up its nuclear deterrent because it needs it in a world where the U.S. is still far more conventionally powerful and able to overthrow governments at will. Russia is highly dependent. I mean, Russia's, the modernized military, they can play the game now in small ways, a short distance from their borders, Syria and the near abroad, right?
The U.S. has military bases. The U.S. has military bases all across Russia's borders, and Russia does not have military bases across the U.S. borders. And so the counter move to that is nuclear weapons. You come into our country, we're going to blow up yours. Period. And so they need it.
Russia, Putin made clear that Russia does not have a first strike policy with nuclear weapons, unlike the United States, that they will not fire nuclear weapons unless nuclear weapons are fired on by them, which is actually. That caused me to shake my head a little bit, but
saying if you guys come in here, we're gonna all the street signs are gonna point towards Stalingrad.
That's what I would say.
Towards Stalingrad. We got to stop. We're out of time, Mark.
Okay.
So thanks a lot. We'll speak with you again next week. Sorry we missed you a couple times over the last month, but we're not gonna let that happen anymore.
All right.
Bye. And that's all the news we have for you right now for Community Public Radio. I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks. For listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. As the Trump administration pulls out of a key arms control agreement, NATO conducts a massive exercise in the Arctic. Is a new front being opened up? And it seems the Saudis will get away with murder after all. Cross-talking some real news. I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Glenn Deason. He is a professor at the Higher School of Economics, as well as author of The Decay of Western Civilization and Resurgence of Russia. And we have Earl Rasmussen. He is the executive vice president of the Eurasia Center. All right, gentlemen, cross-talk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime I want. I want to talk about the fallout from the IMF treaty that the Trump administration is withdrawing from. I think it's a significant story. The foreign policy blob seems to agree with us for a change, or maybe we're agreeing with them. Also, I want to talk about these NATO exercises, which I don't think are getting enough Western coverage in the media. It's a significant event, and with the withdrawal from the INF treaty and these exercises, I think we can draw some conclusions here. Okay, first I want to go to Martin Jay. He's in Beirut. He is a freelance broadcast journalist. Martin, bring us up to speed what's going on with the Khashoggi affair and how Turkey is behind the scenes pulling a lot of strings and a lot more than that. Go ahead, Martin.
Well, this is not what's being reported, I think, nearly enough by Western media. You have a huge deal on the table between Turkey and Saudi Arabia. We have to remember that these are frenemies. These are not very close allies in the region. Saudi Arabia hates Turkey for being friends and supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood. It hates it for being close to Qatar and Iran. And it sees it in terms of hegemony as being a sort of a competitor, if you like. And so what Turkey's been doing, Erdogan has been capitalizing on this extraordinary Khashoggi affair, and he's trying to milk it for everything he can get. And the things that we're hearing, what I'm hearing from my sources in Turkey, is he's holding out for a better deal on Qatar, much more investment in Turkey, obviously from the Saudis, you know, and more, and perhaps sensationally, a sort of assistance, if you like, from the Saudis in his bigger plan, his bigger ambitions in the region, if you'd like, to be a much more bigger regional player. He's got quite huge ambitions about the role of Turkey in the Middle East.
Okay, Martin, what are the chances of his success? I mean, his he gets everything in his bucket list. What are the possibilities of that?
It's really difficult to say. I mean, what the most interesting, I think, takeaway from the investor conference a few days ago, which the Saudis held, which was Mohammed bin Salman actually mentioned briefly how positive he was about Qatar. For me, that was a signal, that was a sign, a coded sign to the Americans and to the Turks that, hey, look, we could trade Qatar, we could lift the blockade on Qatar, but some of this other stuff, this pie-in-the-sky stuff coming from Turkey, at the moment, you know, there's just no chance that we're going to give the Turks any of that. So I think that really Erdogan has just held out too far. He's bitten off far too much that he can chew in these deals, and that's why we've got this stalemate, and that's why we're getting more and more sensational press leaks and threats from Erdogan, because, you know, he's got the Saudis exactly where he wants them, on their back feet, and he's holding out for a bigger deal. But I don't think he's going to get the big one, the real El Grande, if you like, of being helped by Saudi Arabia in his regional ambitions to be a bigger power.
Okay, Martin, we're going to leave it at that. We'll have you on next week with the update. Thank you very much. And let me go to you here, Mark. Let me reflect on what Martin had to say.
Yeah, I mean, we've long discussed Erdogan is a cunning beast, but ultimately his greed is running away with him here. His ambitions.
Do you think it means that they do have the audio and videotapes?
Oh, I have no doubt about that. This with bloody Gina Haspel taking a trip over there. And
head
she
of the CIA.
The head of the CIA. And she said that she found the evidence compelling. That was the words that she used, compelling. So I think Erdogan, though, is his neo-Ottoman ambitions have perhaps gone a bit too far here. And certainly Saudi may lay off of Qatar. The United States wants them to do that as well. And it hasn't netted them any benefits. And Qatar certainly hasn't been buckling down. But ultimately, Mohammed bin Salman is going to be ruling Saudi Arabia for a long time.
Well, that's what I want to get at. Okay.
He will not forget this.
Well, that's the big debate right here, okay? Because I've been watching very closely expert opinion that I trust, and it's not 100% sure. I think it's likely that he will stick around. Mm-hmm. It's not 100% sure. What do you think?
No, and I think obviously they would like for him to go. Same as Americans, I think they would also prefer him to go and replace with someone else. But at the end of the day, it's starting to look as if he's not going anywhere. And essentially, I think they now want to sell the story that, you know, it was an accident or a whole list of excuses. But at the end of the day, I think that there's a lot of will in the U.S. and also Europe to begin to buy this story as well. So
I have a list of excuses with me here. Earl, what do you think? I mean, it's really put Trump and Macron, as we saw the last few days, but a lot of these European leaders and the American president into somewhat of a fix, I would say.
Yes, it's but I would agree with one, there's a lot of people who would like to see him leave.
But there are a lot of people who would like this to go away, too, right?
A lot of people would like this to go away. I think the Crown Prince is going to be staying in place. But it's very awkward if we look at everything. Oh, it's plausible that they were rogue attackers.
I don't want to believe it if it's true.
Right, right. Okay. Oh, well, we have these $160 billion weapons deal. It's a lot of jobs at stake. We need to be careful on disrupting the region. And, of course, we know Saudi Arabia is behind the oil dollar, the petrodollar, essentially. And so it puts a lot of threats both from an arms sales perspective as well as the stability of the dollar, I would say.
So reputation
well.
Doesn't matter here.
I saw the most honest headline this week, AFP headline, geopolitics complicates justice for murdered journalists. That's it.
I thought that was supposed to be Glenn's line, understatement. Okay.
He's our ally. Move on.
All right, I want to point out to our viewers here, I mean, Foreign Policy with Stephen Walt. This is a brilliant article. How to Get Away with Murder. Saudi edition, and he gives 10 points.
Is this an omnibus?
I'm just going to give a real quickie here. Number one, it never happened. Number two, okay, we did something bad, but we didn't do it on purpose. We can see, we can go through the levels here. We had no choice. Number five, it was for the greater good. Next, everyone does it. Our opponents do it even more than we do. Seven, emphasize restraint. It gets better. Assert special status. What we did wasn't really wrong because we're different. Play the guilt card and apologize. And then number 10, the punchline, the Rumsfeld defense. Stuff happens.
Okay. Oh, that sounds so nicely.
Took the wind out of here. No, but see, but this is a bit satirical, obviously, but there's a lot of truth to this, okay? And what I'm pointing out, and I think what Walt's pointing out here, is the rank hypocrisy. If this had been an Iranian dissident going into an Iranian consulate in Istanbul, and the same story came out, there would be United Nations Security Council resolutions, there would be more sanctions, there would be threats of war. But not in this case.
I think what makes this a bit different is because the Turks have been releasing the information gradually, the Saudis actually go through all of these steps now.
So
because,
don't tell the truth.
Well, if you...
So don't tell the truth.
Yeah, yes, but if the Turks were releasing everything at once, then the Saudis could adjust their excuse according to that list. But because new evidence comes out every day, they're going to have to run through the whole
this
list.
This is Erdogan. What did you expect?
Oh, okay.
He's playing the bazaar. Yeah.
Absolutely. He's playing this. He has, it was said, he's got all the information. I think the evidence is real. And he's leaking this on. He's got his strategic objectives that he wants to obtain. And he's going to pull this out. Basically, it's almost like a ransom game going on. Yeah, absolutely.
Erdogan plays, a cunning short-term game. But from a few years ago, when Turkey had no enemies, Erdogan, in the past few years, has annoyed or pissed off the United States with this business in Syria with the Kurds, Russia by shooting down one of their planes and continuing to back jihadists in Syria, now Saudi Arabia, Israel, every surrounding power, of course, from Greece to Armenia. I'm not betting on a long life expectancy for Mr. Erdogan personally. You can only push things too far. You can't piss off every superpower.
But there's one thing you and I have agreed on ever since we've been talking about this man. He's a survivor, and I think that's what he's best at, okay, surviving all of this here. Playing these different factions and countries off each other, that's what keeps him in power. I think he will be around for a long time.
Yes, well, it's also the domestic support for him, of course. So, but if the economy goes, that might unravel as well. So at the end of the day,
he's extorting. Okay, first the Qataris are underwriting him right now, and now he wants the Saudis to start doing it too.
Yeah, well, I think Mark kind of pointed out well that short term he seems to have a lot of leverage. He can squeeze the Saudis for a lot, but in the long run, there might be that, especially if MBS stays in power, that
there will be repercussions.
That they will essentially get back at him because every country does some dodgy spy stuff.
Through a possible proxy? Could we see that, like with Syria, which we'll talk about in a second?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, they don't really have the same interests.
The Saudis are effectively underwriting the Kurds right now. The proxy government that the U.S. is setting up, Saudi Arabia, is paying for that, which is one of the reasons, of course, why the United States is. Government, at least, is pushing this under the table as far as they can. But revenge is a dish.
I'm sure we will be talking about this right before we go to the break here, Earl. U.S. policy, the crown prince may stay or go, but the policy with Saudi Arabia stays.
Stays, absolutely. It's been in place for decades. And I also, additionally, the U.S., part of this whole, their whole national strategy, their policy, is to maintain, is basically being the external
guarantor
of the Middle East. The oil flow, access to it, the control of it, and the partnership with Saudi Arabia.
Against Iran. Okay.
Against Iran.
They've also brought Saudi Arabia and Israel together as friends. I mean, that's quite an accomplishment. Remarkable thing.
And ignored Yemen.
All right, gentlemen. Yemen. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go to Earl here. During the break, you mentioned the Wolfowitz Doctrine. Why? Go ahead.
Well, Peter, I look at this, you know, we talked earlier about full spectrum dominance and an influence over not just the region, but globally. And if we look back at the Wolfowitz Doctrine, the whole basis of that was U.S. supremacy and being the only sole superpower and doing whatever's necessary to maintain that status. And you've got Paul Wolfowitz involved. You've got Vice President Cheney had a special role in that. Bolton was actually part of those different cabinets and different positions during that time frame. And it went from starting out in the Reagan and the Bush 1 time period, really kind of carried
blown
over.
Full blown into Bush 2,
right, correct. It actually took basic shifts, but maintained the same tenets that were originally documented. And basically, as Senator, the deceased late Senator Edward Kennedy said, this is a doctrine for U.S. supremacy and imperialism, one that no country should go along and support.
Okay, but
this is a senator.
And then it went through Obama, and now this is bipartisan,
correct,
here. This ties into the withdrawal from the INF treaty, which I think is really interesting because full spectrum dominance means being able to act unilaterally, okay? And this is exactly what's happening in this administration here. And John Bolton has been a long proponent of unilateral action.
Yeah, it's unilateral, and there's been a lot of folks on the European uproar. However, I wouldn't overstate it or exaggerate it too much because we've seen this in the past. If you remember back in 1999 when the United States under Clinton argued that perhaps they should start to develop a missile defense shield, what happened in Europe? You had the Germans, the French, the Spanish, Italians, the Dutch, essentially all of Western Europe united, said, no, this is a horrible idea. You're going to disrupt the nuclear balance of power. The Russians are going to have to compensate. Yes, they're going to have to compensate somehow. The INF might unravel. All these arguments came out. However, what happened? 2 years later, when the United States actually did withdraw from it, they said, well, these are the new realities. Either you can accept it or you can begin to risk our alliance solidarity. And essentially, everyone started to fall in line. And I think it was not just accidental. This is a very deliberate strategy. And we found that out through the WikiLeaks, because in Norway, we have, you know, very interesting territory for these radars in terms of getting proper footprint of Russia. And yeah, the U.S. ambassador to Norway, he pretty much was very open, saying, well, we're going to put a lot of pressure on the Norwegians, make them change their mind because we opposed it, and essentially break this down to being all about alliance solidarity. Once this becomes the issue, they will turn. And then a few months later, he reported back, yes, we put some pressure on the government, journalists, everyone, look, done a 180, and so we all fell in line. That's my point.
The ABM treaty didn't forecast a possible arms race. The withdrawal from the INF could mark.
I disagree.
And it's not necessarily, you know, let me be very clear here. I can see the flaws and the weaknesses of this treaty that was... The Warsaw Pact existed at the time here, but the walking away from it without replacing it or even beginning to start some kind of new talks about nonproliferation and arms control, I think that's the mistake. Go ahead.
Well, I think that the U.S. pulling out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty back in 2001 most certainly did start a new arms race. And Russia's new frontline weapons, hypersonic missiles, they're all specifically designed. They announced then, we're going to have to take measures. They announced while they're developing them, and they announced when they're deploying them, which is what's happening now. But Bolton must have a scorecard of international treaties
that he's getting rid of.
He's decapitated one by one because he was instrumental in back in 2001. 2001 and pulling the U.S. pulling out of the ABM. He's got the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action now, the Treaty of Amity and Friendship between the U.S. and Iran, and now he's the one driving, at least according to the Washington Post and others in the Western mainstream media, the U.S. pulling out of the INF Treaty. But there's been some quite interesting events going on. So John Bolton came to Moscow in the last week, and he met with Putin. And Putin had quite a comment for him. As far as I remember, the U.S. seal depicts an eagle on one side holding 13 arrows. And on the other side is an olive branch with 13 olives. Here's the question. Did your eagle eat all the olives and only the arrows are left? And Bolton replied, I didn't bring any more olives. And Putin just...
Yeah, I thought so.
So yeah. But Bolton announced in Georgia, in Tbilisi, that that the U.S. wants to hold strategic conversations, meaning nuclear, in context of a conversation with the press about the INF, with Russia, about China. And that's my point last week, that Trump might actually be trying to, whether he'll get it done or not is another matter, but his goal might be a new international INF that brings China and Japan and the EU
into
it.
That's possible, but Glenn, it seems kind of counterintuitive to me, because then that would crimp this unilateralism, okay? That would be a change for like Bolton to suggest that when he is a unilateralist to the core, why would he want to be the father of an international
Bolton government? Is cunning enough to just sell it that way and then change gears later.
Cunning is one thing. He's a bureaucratic infighter, right, but I mean about reality. Go ahead.
Well, ideally in international treaties, you want to constrain your adversaries, but not yourself. And I think the legitimate weakness of the INF is that was drawn up in 87. So this was a bipolar distribution of power. And for that reason, it constrained Moscow and Washington. Now, so I think it's fair to say that, you know, you have all this, you have Pakistan, you have the Chinese, you have a lot of other countries now who doesn't have to abide by it. So in order to draw more countries into it, fair enough, as you pointed out, I think it's time for updating these international treaties, given that the world has gone through a lot of changes. Walking away from it, it might just be his tactic that,
and
you
this
know.
This is a preamble to the, I guess we, Mark, maybe you know, Earl, maybe you know, but there are no discussions about dealing with the New START treaty that's going to expire in 2021.
The Trump administration has given indication that it is not looking favorably on renewing it.
Okay, let's talk about NATO. We have really huge exercises in the Arctic. I think it's the first time in 30 years an American aircraft carrier is in the Arctic in this exercise here. As I said in my introduction, opening up of a new frontier?
It sure does look like it. We have the largest exercises since the end of the Cold War. I used to participate in some of those exercises back in the 80s.
You too, Mark, right?
Not in the 80s.
The 90s.
In the 90s.
So, late 80s. And we've got the ABM or sites being set up in Poland, Romania. I think Czech's got a targeting radar facility in. We've got now it looks like we're going to be moving a division into Poland, forward stationed. And we've got some troops in our rotational bases in the Baltics. Sure does appear that we've got a unprovoked, by the way, a kind of forward movement of a new front occurring.
Why is Norway so keen on, at least official Norway, so keen on this kind of things? I thought you were a kind of a peaceful people.
Well, fair enough. No, well, the
Vikings!
Well, the country's a bit divided on this, because in the north, they do a lot of work with Russia, and relations are quite good. Also, they remember the Second World War, because we were under Nazi occupation, and the Red Army actually came in to the north of the country and liberated it. And once it was liberated, they pretty much said, you're welcome, and they went back. So we didn't have that Eastern European experience, essentially. So, but in Oslo, we adapted that narrative of the Poles, because that's the NATO solidarity, like the Russians will come for us. But in the north, they never bought into this. So the country is a little bit divided on this. But that being said, you are correct. I mean, in terms of per capita, Norway is second only to the U.S. in NATO in terms of military spending. Since last year, we began hosting American troops in Norway. Now we're putting the British up in the Arctic. We're developing the in Vardu the radio, that's a radar, to monitor Russia. So there's a lot of what can be interpreted as hostile.
Certainly from Russia's perspective, I mean, you have this vast military alliance, but ever moving closer to your border.
But there's a reason behind it, though, because in the Arctic it's developing very fast at the moment, and.
And so you militarize it, huh? Yeah, why don't you just say a demilitarized Arctic and get everybody to sign that?
Yes,
wouldn't that be a better idea?
Yes, but Arctic will be, it looks like it might be Chinese and Russian-led, because in January of this year, the Chinese released their first white paper on the Arctic. They refer to it as the Polar Silk Road. So essentially they're putting the Arctic route into their One Road, One Belt, and Russia is now accommodating them to cooperate to develop the Arctic. So for transportation, east-west, energy, scientific development. Gas. So there will be a lot of cooperation there. And so essentially what the Americans and British are saying is, no,
there's going to be a lot of competition, okay, yeah. Also.
No, you're right. It's mostly military tools that NATO has to counter this. So,
Mark, NATO is a military organization looking for a mission, the Arctic.
Well, I mean, we've seen this Cold War tensions. We've talked about it on the show. Andacana, NATO's Andacana last year was the biggest military exercise since the end of the Cold War. Then Russia had their Vostok 2018, just a few months ago we talked it, biggest military exercises since the end of the Cold War, albeit they were very far from NATO's borders in the Far East. And now NATO is back again with Trident Juncture. We're talking some 50,000 troops, 250 aircraft, 65 Navy vessels, 10,000 military vehicles, all parked right on Russia's borders. And they're practicing this shipping. All right, what would actually happen in a conflict against Russia on the continent of bringing into a conflict theater large amounts of military equipment from the U.S. and all
but
over
NATO
the rest of Europe.
But NATO says that Russia is not the target of this exercise.
Well, that's completely ridiculous. But the Norwegian defense minister did say one honest thing. Russia is not a direct threat to Norway. Well, it isn't, but you're doing your best to make
it. Okay, let me give Glenn the last word as a Norwegian here.
Well, he makes that, I've seen him many times speak, and he always makes that argument. They're not a direct threat to Norway. However, Norway has to look after its allies, which I find interesting because the British, a British general made the argument yesterday that, they're a threat to Norway and we have to look after allies. So it seems that no one is seeing a direct Russian attack on them, but we're just very warm and fluffy and want to look after.
Well, we want to keep that NATO solidarity.
Yeah. Now, solidarity is really the new...
The warm and fluffy and fluffy military alliance. All right, that's all the time we have here. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow and in Beirut. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio. .org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.